Good afternoon. One day several years ago, when I was up in the fire tower over in Wakefield, I saw far off among the treetops a man on a staging, struggling with a plank. He pulled first one end and then the other. And when he finally got the plank into place, he nailed it fast. I turned to the observer in the tower and said, "Who's that fella over on that ledge? And what in the world is he trying to build?" Oh, the observer said, "That's Mr. Clarence Hoag. He says he's building a castle. He's been working at it now for 5 or 6 years, all by himself. But I doubt if he'll ever get it finished." That, as I said, was all of 10 years ago. Today, Castle Clare is not only finished, but furnished as a castle should be. And a few weeks ago, we were royally entertained there. Mr. Hoag was born in the royalist town of Shelburne, Nova Scotia. And because he can trace his ancestry straight back to Scottish nobility on one side of the family and to King Alfred the Great on the other, he's always been interested in English history. While other boys were sailing boats and playing Indians, Clare Hoag built castles. He played castle all day, and he dreamed about them at night. And in the back of his boyish mind, that developed a desire to someday have a castle of his own. When he was 14, he went to work in the print shop of the local Shelburne, Nova Scotia newspaper. His boss was an irascible old cuss, but he helped Clare Hoag by firing him, which was the best thing that could have happened. Clare's father bought him a small printing press, and at the age of 16, young Mr. Hoag started his own newspaper, the Shelburne Express, and it wasn't long before he had enough money to buy a new suit, a traveling bag, and a ticket to Boston. When he got here in the hub, he found employment in a printing house, and he's been in that business for 50 years, now owning his own fine printing plant in the Grain Exchange Building at the corner of Milk and India Streets. Eventually, he married and moved out to Wakefield, where his boys and girls could grow up in the country. With his own hands, he built a home and two other houses at the foot of the hill on which his castle stands today. After long, hard days in the print shop in Boston, Mr. Hoag would come home, have his supper, then climb up to the crest of the hill to watch the sunset. And every time he went up there, the urge to build a castle became stronger and stronger. He would have started then, but he was in poor health, and he was too tired. But he did go around, clearing up brush and brambles and hauling away rocks in his wheelbarrow. One day, he staked out a pathway, and as time went by, it began to look like a road. And that was encouraging, so he kept at it. And when his neighbors would ask what he was doing up there on the hill, Mr. Hoag would smile and say, "Oh, I'm just building me a castle." Well, the outdoor work and the exercise agreed with him, and his health improved. And when winter came, he kept right on working, cutting out trees, burning stumps, carting away rocks. And at the end of 3 years, he had a fine winding driveway leading from the base of that hill to the very summit, every last foot of it made with his own hands. And on the sloping sides, he transplanted more than 1,000 trees. Now it was time to start planning the castle he dreamed about all his life. But Clarence Hoag was past 50. His 10 children were grown up and some were married and had children of their own. How long, he asked himself, would it take him to build a castle single-handed? 2 years? 5? Maybe 10? "Oh, well," he said, "I might as well have fun building a castle as playing golf or poker or chasing the ponies." So one day in 1930, he paced off the size of the ledge on top of the ridge and found it was exactly the size he wanted for his foundation. So he got his tools together, ordinary hammers, saw, chisel, and so forth, no power tools at all. He put them in the wheelbarrow and started up the hill. And when he got there, he built the forms into which he poured his cement, sand, and gravel. And slowly but surely, the base of his castle took shape. But it was another 3 years before he finished the foundation. And by that time, the whole country was in the grip of the Depression. There was no business, no work, no money, nothing but expenses. And Mr. Clarence Hoag was in no condition financially to start building a castle. But, and I think this is the best part of the story, instead of abandoning his dream, he looked around for second-hand material, some stuff that he could get for a song. And as many buildings were being torn down, he found a lot of things. He bought a few bushels of brick, some steel girders, load after load of unmatched but perfectly good lumber. And everywhere he went looking for printing business, he kept his eye peeled for things that would go into the castle. On State Street, for instance, he saw workmen ripping up tiling, and he bought a whole load for $10. He purchased squares of pink and white marble from the floor of a department store, and he got other tiles from the porch of the art museum in Boston. Over in Malden, he found some leaded glass windows from the old Malden Auditorium and a pair of massive iron gates and decorative iron lanterns with heavy chains and two beautiful hand-wrought iron brackets weighing 400 pounds apiece, just the things for a castle. And as he kept searching and finding these treasures, his excitement grew until finally on a day in 1933, he put up the frame and started the first sills of his famous castle out there in Wakefield. He was then 56 years old. He'd already labored 5 years on the grounds and 3 years more on the foundations. And he said optimistically, "If I have my health, I ought to be able to finish this job in 10 years. But it was nearly 15 from the time he started before Castle Clare was completed. When we drove out, or I should say up there a few weeks ago, I knew we were going to see something unusual. But I was wholly unprepared to find such a striking and unique structure. From a distance in the morning haze, it looked not unlike the La Fonda Hotel in Santa Fe. But as we climbed the hill, passed between tall stone towers and stopped at the main gate of Castle Clare, with its triple doors, four domed arches above, balconies and glassed-in porches above that, and towers and turrets above all, I was reminded of the castles I had seen in England and had observed from the steamer as we sailed up the Rhine. Although made entirely of wood, Castle Clare is cleverly designed to resemble stone. And with its white square towers rising 300 feet from the valley below, it is indeed a surprising and imposing sight. And I got another surprise when I met the man who built it. For Mr. Hogue is a small, soft-spoken gentleman with keen dark eyes and blue-black hair. The few wrinkles around his eyes are laugh lines. And not knowing his age at the time of our shaking hands, I put him down as a man in his 50s. A live, out-of-doors man with a natural appreciation of artistic things, a fine sense of humor, and considerable modesty about his many accomplishments. With a wave of his hand, he indicated the artificial pond he'd made right on top of that ledge, with a decorative island covered with trees. And he added, "The pond sort of takes the place of a moat." We entered through a modern kitchen, and following a winding staircase, we came into one of the many magnificent overlooking mile upon mile of green countryside hundreds of feet below us. We met Mrs. Hogue, who was Alexandra Bradshaw, a charming and talented artist, who until her marriage to Mr. Hogue 3 years ago was director of the art department at the State College at Fresno, California. Mrs. Hogue has fitted up one of the tower rooms for her studio, and there she works in watercolor. All over this amazing dream house, we saw evidences of her skill technique. Marines and landscapes from the main coast, Cape Cod in California. And at the foot of the main staircase, we admired a striking portrait in oils that she had painted of her husband. Other paintings by Mr. Hogue's brothers adorn the eastern end of the Great Hall. Huge oil portraits of the Hogue ancestry. A copy of Rayburn's Warrior. Portraits of Wallace and Bruce and Mary Queen of Scots. While at the western end, we saw a splendid study of Field Marshal Douglas Haig. In the center of the castle is really Mr. Hogue's prize achievement. It's 21 by 51 and a few inches shy of being 20 feet high. We could put our modest house in the center of that medieval hall and have plenty of space to walk around it. As we entered the great hall from the left through high Gothic doors, we saw first the family box raised a few feet from the floor, with tall, carved mahogany chairs. The family may enter this box to watch what's going on from their private suite in back, and directly opposite is the orchestra balcony, complete with podium, music stands, and piano. There are three balconies at varying levels, and branching off these are the various suites into which the castle is divided. Looking down on that vast polished floor, every board of which Mr. Hogue laid with his own hands, we saw beautiful Chinese vases, tall bronze urns, enormous tarshas, bearskin rugs, a knight in armor, and the very modern touch of a TV set. We had luncheon in the long, narrow dining room at the left of the great hall, then adjourned to the library to see some of the Kodachromes Mr. Hogue has made around the castle. From the library wall behind us, the wives of Henry VIII looked on approvingly. One of Mr. Hogue's sons, Thomas Hogue, occupies a suite beside the library. In fact, he was married in the castle right after it was completed, and we dropped in to hear some recordings of his musical compositions. Young Thomas Hogue is a graduate of the New England Conservatory and is an accomplished musician. Then our host led us up flight after flight of winding stairs to the very top of the Twin Towers. And hanging onto our hats, we went out on the flying bridge, which connects the towers, for a breathtaking view of the countryside below. To the south and west, we saw Wakefield, Malden, and Boston. And in the distance, the South Shore and Cape Cod. Then east to Winthrop, Swampscott, and Marblehead. And looking northwest on clear days, the Hogues can see Monadnock and the White Mountains. Peering down over the parapet, Mr. Hogue spotted a bit of peeling paint. Ah, me, he sighed. I guess I'll have to start painting again. And I shuddered at the mere thought of tackling a structure as big as that with a paintbrush. I said, you'll have help, of course. Oh, no, he answered, I'll do it in my time, after hours and weekends. And then he added, it took me 3 months to sand and paint just the floors inside. Now I've got to tackle the outside of the building. I said, you mean you didn't have any help building this castle at all? Only on the heating plant, wiring, and plumbing. I did everything else myself. Why, I worked up here when I had to sweep away snow. And nights when it was too cold to work outside, I sat close to the fireplace and built furniture. As it was difficult to talk against the wind, we descended to one of the huge glassed-in porches. He had beautiful ladder-back chairs with neatly woven rush seats. And he said, I found a furniture man who had a lot of odd chairs and pieces. I bought the whole business and kind of rebuilt them and fixed them up. I wove the cane bottoms. It was a lot of fun, and it kept me busy. It must have kept him quite busy to put all the weather stripping on those doors and windows, for I counted over 100, and I'm sure there must be more. Then we asked about the fireplaces we'd observed in every room, and Mr. Hogue smiled. You know, a contractor was demolishing a fine old mansion, and he gave me all that marble. It was great fun rearranging it to fit. Yes, I made all of the fireplaces, and I built the chimneys, too. I like working so permanent like the old castles over in Europe. How that man, past middle age and not too strong, ever had the courage to start building such a structure in the middle of the Depression is beyond my comprehension. Next spring, he'll be 75. He doesn't look a day over 60. And I says, building the castle of my dreams with my own hands, young, and brought me good health. And I can see that hunting for beautiful things to finish it has also had its compensations. This whole unbelievable story is aptly summed up in verse by Mr. Hogue's good friend, Warren B. Jennings, in a poem called A Toast to Castle Clare. To idle dreamers who have sought in vain their castles in the air, a forceful lesson can be taught. Come, let her. There, high upon a rocky hill, her towers pressed against the sky, she stands a sight indeed to thrill the dreamer's soul, the poet's eye. One man who dreamed was not content in dreams to let his castle fade. Long hours in drawing plans he spent, and then a firm foundation laid. Now patiently he built the frame, each beam and rafter placed just so. Then floors and stairs and walls, the same as he had dreamed that they must go. Days lengthened into, while idle dreamers such as I saw fruitless hopes dissolve in tears. He had the will to toil and try. So high upon yon rocky hill, she stands so noble and so fair, a toast to one who did fulfill his dream to Castle Clare.